Okay, thank you for coming out. For those who don't know, my name is Lindsay Hanson Park, and I'm the new assistant director of Sunstone. And of course, Mary Ellen's no longer with us, but she's with us in spirit. So I'm just so glad to see so many people coming out and supporting us. We had a great conference in Seattle. And how many people are repeating from Seattle? There's not very many. This is like two or three. So great. So one thing that we're going to be doing that's new for Sunstone is we're trying to provide a swag bag every conference. So make sure you get your swag bag. And in this particular swag bag, you have an issue of the magazine, and you have Eye Plates, which is a comic book donated by Stephen Carter. So those are for you to keep. And there's just one change. I'm not sure how many of you are planning to go to Salt Lake City, but we have our Singles in the Borderlands conference with Elna Baker coming up, and it's a conference aimed to discuss the issues of being a single person in the LDS Church. You don't have to be single to go. But our date is actually December 6th, and Elna Baker has found out that she has an HBO audition, so we're moving it to December 20th. So I don't know if you're going, but if you're going, it's now December 20th. So another thing that I want to say really quick is I just want to give a big, big thank you to the Community of Christ who have lent us this beautiful building and given us a wonderful tour. Are they allowed to go look upstairs? Yeah, it's an amazing, gorgeous building. So Pastor Val Walker, can you come up for just a minute? We just wanted to say thank you from Sunstone for your generosity. So Community of Christ is always so kind and giving. And so we have a Sunstone for you and your congregation, and then a swag bag of your own. So hooray, you get Mormon books, just what you wanted. So if we could just give them a round of applause. And I want to recognize Kimi Winger from the board of Sunstone. He is here as well. So thank you for coming. So we're going to get started in just a minute. I'm going to turn the time over to Laurie Bush to talk about the quilting. But I'm just going to kind of tell you, again, this is a really experimental format, so I appreciate everyone being patient. We're trying something new. So it could be a big disaster. And if it is, like, we'll just put on our pioneer spirit and, you know, keep trekking along. So we have quilts from set up here that Laurie and several others, Lisa and Amanda, have been working really hard to set up. And the purpose for that is I spent some time this summer with some people in Salt Lake City. I'm sure you guys are aware, but there's a problem with displaced LDS youth who are LGBTI, who are kicked out of their homes for one reason or another for their orientation. And it's becoming quite a problem in Salt Lake City specifically. And of course, it's a problem everywhere, but in Salt Lake City specifically, it's a Mormon problem. So we've decided this year at Sunstone to try to make a year of giving hope to these youth. And so we're starting here with your help, with Laurie's help. We're going to make quilts and tie them in the sort of old Mormon language. You know, it's a very material Mormon language to quilts and show comfort and love that way. So we're not asking that you have to do that, but if you want to get back to your Mormon roots, while we are having the presentation, you're welcome to quilt, and Laurie's going to explain it to you in just a minute. But the quilts are going to be split up. We're going to be giving some to Affirmation here to give to Mormon youth in Portland locally, and then we're going to take one quilt back to Salt Lake City, and we're going to be writing messages of love and hope for these children, and so they will be given on the streets. Right now, there are some really complicated laws in Utah with shelters taking in children. It's really actually very sad, but there's laws prohibiting people from taking in gay youth without parental permission. So we're doing the best we can, and we're trying to get quilts. So I just really appreciate you guys trying that. So again, it's really unusual to sit here and quilt and listen, but we thought we would use the night to talk about hope and love. And it's been a really hard year for Mormonism in general, with politics and Mitt Romney and polygamy and excommunication. And so we're using this night to kind of mourn with those who mourn and comfort those who stand in need of comfort and try to find hope in the gospel and hope in one another. So let me give the mic to Laura for just a minute to explain the quilting.
If we need more chairs, we can
Okay. Down
and put more chairs in.
Sure. Yeah, we'll just put it up. We're good.
Okay.
I'm not used to speaking on a microphone in this room because I've got a really big voice and I'm used to talking really loud. Anyway, welcome. Thank you so much for being willing to serve these youth. This is something that is very close to my heart. I come from a long line of quilters. These are time quilts, but for the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of quilts that we've tied for seniors who are going off to college or girls at girls camp, this tonight, the quilting that we're doing tonight and those we are serving is wonderful. So if you would like to help with that, we've got chairs back here around this one. If we need to make more room over here, we can just have that quilt up and then put another one on that one when we're done. But I wanted you, everybody, to make sure you see the one that's over here. That's the rainbow one. And next to it are a bunch of fine tip markers. And we'd ask if you would like to, we would love you to be able to just write a message of love on one of the squares or in the border. And then that one will be tied and we will get messages of love on that one, but we wanted to have both up. So if you know how to tie quilts already, we would really love you to come back and help with us. If you haven't before but want to, just even a stitch or two, I can teach you how to do that. And otherwise, if you have any questions, we'll be really quiet back there. There you go.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and get started. And can we just give all our volunteers a round of applause, especially the volunteers? Like quilting and stitching and binding all of this stuff, which is a lot of work. So I think it's fantastic. And I just wanted to say, so we're going to have some musical numbers tonight, too. We're kind of doing this in sort of like a sort of Mormon-style, fireside-style venue or setup, but there is going to be something different. At the end, we have dessert, and dessert will be presented to us by Geraldine Poole as Aunt Marvel. And if you have not seen any of Aunt Marvel's presentations, you're in for a treat. It's a little bit of a wild treat, but you won't be disappointed. So we'll get started with that, but I just wanted to thank our presenters tonight, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about them before we get started, and then we'll start with the opening prayer. So we have Kurt Cottle. I'm sure you guys know Kurt Cottle. Kurt Cottle has been in the news this year. He has a master's degree in spiritual traditions and ethics from Merrill Hurst University. He is the host of the Mormon Book Review podcast and was previously a religion instructor for BYU Idaho. And he will be followed by a musical presentation from Jane Ann Peterson. And I think everyone in Portland knows Jane Ann. She is over-degreed and in charge of too many things, but music making retains relatively high priority. She has been involved in online space, Mormon feminism, for over 20 years. And then, of course, we have Dan Witherspoon over here, and we're so lucky to have him. He drove up from Salt Lake City. He is a writer, editor, and host of the Mormon Matters podcast. He led the Sunstone Education Foundation from 2001 to 2008. He has a master's and PhD in religion. He is active in his Utah ward where he lives with his wife, Lori, and he served in the Washington Seattle Mission in 83 and 84. And then Stephanie Cottle, who is here, and she's going to be doing a music performance as well. And she is currently attending beauty school and has a passion for singing. She finds the best way for her to praise God is via her voice. She's been married for 14 years and has four children, and she has an impeccable style. Sorry, but I'm embarrassed with that. She's fantastic. I want her to dress me. So then we have John Hastings, who's here as well. And he is originally from the Wasatch Front, but for the past 12 years has called Portland his home. He lives with his boyfriend, Ryan, and at times attends the Summer Lake Ward. He works in accounting finance by day. By night on the weekends, he works on the steering committee for Mormons Building Bridges and as an associate producer for Far Between, a documentary about the experience of LGBT Mormons, which is fantastic. And you can check that out online, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, Geraldine Poole, who is hiding in the kitchen. She's a mother, wife, grandmother, and graphic artist. She moderates and writes for Feminist Mormon Housewives and doesn't even try to stay out of trouble. She lives in Medford, Oregon, and has the best calling in the world, pianist for the local Spanish branch. So we're going to go ahead and get started with the prayer, and then we'll get into it. And then, of course, feel free to quilt. Go in the back and quilt if you would like. And make sure that you at least try to give at least one stitch in the quilt if you're able to. So, Kimi Wanger.
think we missed one introduction, so just to introduce one other person, Lindsay Hansen Park is a Dr. Pepper addict and an inveterate organizer of events. She doesn't let a day go by without organizing an event of some kind that helps everybody around her. And we are very blessed to have her here at Sunstone. So thank you to Lindsay for organizing this. When we look around us and see the difference, I mean, when she says this is an experiment, this is Lindsay saying, how can we take this community and help other people? And it's something that's fantastic. So thank you for being part of our community, Lindsay, as well. Our dearest mother and father, we gather together today to spend time in each other's company and to try to serve those around us. And we ask you to please bless our hands that we can be useful, that the work we do can be helpful in clothing those who are in need of warmth. And we ask that we can also use the lessons that we learned today to be uplifted and to go out and to do good all around us. And we thank you, Father and Mother, for all of the wonderful blessings around us, our world, and all of the family and friends that surround us, and all of the opportunities we have to serve others. We ask you to always watch over us and bless us with your spirit and guidance. And we say this in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.
Well, it's nice. This is on, right? Okay. I never like holding microphones, and I like standing behind podiums. So hopefully this goes all right. But I really liked Seattle last night. I was up there and had a great time, so I'm looking forward to being able to speak today also. For anyone that missed the introduction, my name's Kurt Caudill, and I've been a member of the church my entire life. But recently, after much prayer, meditation, discussion, and soul-searching, I officially resigned my membership from the church. I'm sure many of you have heard my story, and some of you probably haven't. Some of you may have only heard parts of it on podcasts, news articles from friends, or some other kind of place. But I'm going to refrain on going into depth on any of that today. Suffice to say, I taught at the Portland, Oregon Institute for a few years, teaching New Testament classes and later religion courses for BYU, Idaho. My exit from the institution has not been easy, but it has been soothing and healing in many ways. From the outside, I've had to discover new ways to continue my faith journey, maintain my good relationships with family and friends, and lovingly support those who still do believe. Sometimes I feel a little bit different from others who have separated themselves from the institution because I still claim a deep and personal testimony of the Book of Mormon, of Joseph Smith, and of Jesus Christ. However, what I found is that having a testimony of those things alone is not always enough to remain a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints if such testimonies are not accompanied by those of modern prophets and apostles. Many who have borne such testimonies have felt rejected, left the church, and at times have even experienced formal disciplinary councils. Those in the academy, I believe, face unique struggles in this regard, as was the case with my personal circumstance. However, many of those individuals, even on the outside, still identify some part of themselves as Mormon, as I still do. The gospel does not require... Oh,
I just want to know if we can get one or more expert closers over here, because I know nothing about closing, and I'm going to make a disaster of this.
Don't do anything.
Come on over here. Folks, as we're listening to the wonderful
Christian,
just some
looking
at it. And thank you.
All right, are you done now?
Make sure.
Okay. So the gospel does not require you to know all things. It doesn't even actually require you to have faith. It doesn't require one to believe. It only requires an individual to have a desire to believe. Alma tells those who have been forced out of the synagogue that even if you can no more than desire to believe, let this desire work in you. Those with testimonies of the restoration or are currently outside of the church are left with nothing but this desire. King Benjamin reminds Book of Mormon readers that it is not requisite that a man run faster than he has strength. Nobody knows the strength of a person better than that individual person. A place inside of the institutional church might not be the right fit for everybody at the current time. My thoughts today will explore how those who were once inside of the church or are currently feeling estranged or like unorthodox members can still find positive ways to interact with the institution, deal with their own personal pride, and continue on his or her own faith journey. I believe that this can be done by using the desire spoken of by Alma as a common bond between two parties in order to influence positive dialogue as we change the questions that we're now asking. So how should we go about finding the answers that we seek? We all have questions in our lives and we all have answers. However, not very many of us have very good answers. I know I don't. One way we learn is through literature. In Book 10 of his Republic, Plato bans all of the poets from his ideal city because he sees all these stories as simply imitation. Now, I don't think Plato would be correct in banning the poets, but I do agree that stories are nothing but imitation. Stories are not the things themselves, but are representative of another thing. Jesus taught in parables, or short stories, in order to help people come to answers. Stories help us think and come to our own conclusion on a whole variety of different issues. The parables of Jesus do not enforce upon us one specific doctrinal truth. They do not indoctrinate us. Rather, if we let them, they liberate us. They liberate us by helping us think deeper on a given topic. When we feel we understand the answer to a parable, it is usually somebody, maybe a perceived authority figure, has provided us with that answer. At which point, the thinking has been done. I believe this is exactly the opposite, though, of what Jesus wants from us. He wants the thinking done by us. He does not want the thinking done for us. His parables force us to ask ourselves what we think about God ourselves. They challenge our preconceived notions of right and wrong, of situational ethics, of the morality of our culture. But be very careful with the morals that you espouse right now, even as you sit here. Because as one author states, you can safely assume you've created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people that you do. One common problem that people have in finding the answers that they seek is asking the right questions. Finding the right questions goes a long ways in discovering the truths that we seek. Allow me to relate a story. One day, a man named Jeb had a sick dog, and so Jeb went over to his friend's house to get some advice. Jeb was really distressed, and he told his friend, "My dog's really sick, and I think he's going to die." The friend was silent, and so Jeb continued, "I know your dog was sick like this last week, right?" And the friend nodded in agreement. "Well, what did you do for him?" The friend sat up in his chair and said, "I had him drink this whole bottle of medication that I have here." Jeb asked if he had an extra bottle, and the friend said yes. So Jeb took the bottle, and he thanked him. He rushed home as fast as he could, and he had his dog drink the entire bottle of medication. The next day, Jeb woke up, and he found his dog dead in the living room. Jeb was livid, so he went over to see his friend, and he said, "My dog's dead." His friend nodded and said, "Yeah, that happened to me too." So it's not that Jeb's heart wasn't in the right place, or that he was not honestly searching for an answer. He was asking the wrong questions. That was his problem. And I think all of us fall into the same category. We get so caught up in being right and finding the answers to hard theological questions that we end up accepting the first answer that sounds good. These easily accepted questions, or these easily accepted answers, can either reinforce the faith that we already claim to have, or they can do the opposite and throw us into some sort of existential tailspin. While Jesus taught in parables, he also taught using questions. We usually ask the wrong questions while Jesus helps us find the right questions. Many times Jesus was asked questions and he would end up giving an answer that made no sense whatsoever considering what was just being asked of him. This is the method most often used by the Jesus represented in the Gospel of John. So let's take a conversation between Jesus and Pilate in John 18, 33 through 38 as an example of this. Pilate then went back into the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And then Jesus is going to respond here with a question of his own. "Is that your idea?" Jesus asked. "Or did others talk to you about me? "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "Your own people and chief priests handed you over to me. What is it that you've done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. But if it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You say that I'm king. In fact, the reason I was born and came in the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of the truth listens to me." "What is truth?" retorted Pilate. During this conversation, Jesus gives no straight answers and counters the questions of Pilate with questions of his own. Because what he has to say really does not fit into the pre-established categories of the Jews or of the Romans. Jesus counters Pilate's questions with questions of his own as if to show him if he really desires to find truth, as he asks at the end, then he must transform his current thinking patterns altogether. So know a little about desire and pride. To desire is to be in a particular state of mind. And before we can know what we desire, we must first gain some familiarity with the varieties of different options set before us. We think this sounds good, but it can also be quite scary because being presented with options increases our accountability to those options. We might say that just getting to know people of different religions, sexual orientations, political persuasions will somehow solve our problems. Knowing the situation of others, though, is not enough. Allow me to share an excerpt from a book that goes by the name of First as Tragedy, Then as Farce by the philosopher Slavoj Žižek. The Israeli media loves to dwell on the imperfections and psychic traumas of the Israeli soldiers, presenting them as neither as perfect military machines nor as superhuman heroes, but as ordinary people who are caught up in the traumas of history and warfare. And they sometimes make errors and they lose their way. For example, in January 2003, the IDF demolished the family home of a suspected terrorist, but they did so with accentuated kindness, even helping the family to move their furniture out before destroying the house with a bulldozer. A similar incident was reported a little bit earlier in the Israeli press, when an Israeli soldier was searching a Palestinian house for suspects. The mother of the family called her daughter by name, and in order to calm her down, And the surprised soldier learned that the frightened daughter's name was the same of his own daughter. In a sentimental outburst, he pulled out his wallet and showed her picture to the Palestinian mother. Now, it's easy to discern the falsity of such a gesture of empathy. The notion that, in spite of political differences, we are all basically human beings with the same loves and worries neutralizes the impact of the activity the soldier was engaged in. As such, the only proper reply of the mother should have been, "If you are really a human being like me, then why are you doing what you are doing now?" The soldier could then only have taken refuge in some kind of sense of duty. "I don't like it, but it's my duty," he might say, thus avoiding the subjective assumption of his duty. How often are we in similar positions? And how many times could others ask us the same question as we're acting in some sort of name of duty that the mother asked this soldier? somebody could ask us something like, if you were really human, a human being like me, then why are you doing what you're doing now? We claim to have the desire to love others and then seek to show them this love by random acts of kindness. And we often want to do this with people that we disagree with, as if this is going to make things better. But while we do it, at the same time, we're often judging, attacking, tearing down what they believe, and sometimes even voting to have their human rights taken away. Those on all sides of the faith spectrum like to paint others with a broad brush and categorize people. On the internet, it's common to find many people calling TBMs, or true believing Mormons, if you hang around the Bloggernacle, calling them ignorant, sheep, blind followers of a prophet, uneducated on the issues, and uncaring to those who disagree with them. While on the other side of the fence, faithful Mormons label non-Mormons, or so-called liberal Mormons, as unfaithful, apostates, people who overthink the issues and mingle scriptures with the philosophies of men. I believe that both of these mindsets are problematic and do absolutely nothing to help us better come to conclusions on how to coexist and not only make the world a better place for us to live in, but make a religious space for us all to live in. Loving people takes more than just getting to know somebody or doing nice things for somebody. It takes an entire change of heart, a desire to believe that there is worth in that individual. It takes a questioning of your own morals and a willingness to ask new questions. We refuse to do most of these things because of our pride. Pride keeps us from desiring love. C.S. Lewis says in his landmark work, Mere Christianity, "Do not imagine if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people will call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, smarmy person who is always telling you that, of course. He is a nobody. Probably all you will think about him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. If you do dislike him, it will be because you feel a little envious of anyone who seems to enjoy life so easily. He will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. If anyone would like to acquire humility, I can, I think, tell him the first step. The first step is to realize that one is proud. And that's a biggish step, too. At least, nothing whatsoever can be done before it. If you think you are not conceited, it means you are very conceited indeed." I believe that pride always gets in the way of our desires to love, and it stands in our way, ultimately, in our quest of knowledge. If you are currently on the outside of the church, then do not let your pride get in the way of seeing that the good and humble members of the church do much good in their communities and do much good in their families to make this world a better place. Many of them really do enjoy life very easily, and they should be commended for that. If you are currently on the inside of the church, do not let your pride get in the way of believing that people can find happiness in different paths than your own, and that these people also can still make positive differences in the world that I believe Christ himself would be proud of. In conclusion, I will again echo the words of Alma that I started with. If you can no more than desire to believe, let this desire work in you. No matter where you're currently at on your faith journey, search the desires of your heart and let those desires work in you. Study the parables of Jesus and be open to questioning your own ethics and your own morals. Be ready to discard your own questions and be ready to discover new ones. Let these questions help you discover new ways of combating pride and loving your fellow human beings in novel ways. I believe that those within the institution and those outside of the institutional church can find ways not only to coexist, but to actually support each other in their various journeys. This can happen if our desires are pure and we truly strive to love one another, and by simply asking the question, why am I doing what I'm doing now if I am human just like you? Even though we might not all be sitting on the same pews on Sunday, I would still like to say, as someone now on the outside, that I would like to still consider you all my brothers and sisters. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Jane Ann. Always loves hearing me sing. Love her heart, love friends, or we, I love Emma Lou Fain. Do you all know who she is? Those are her lyrics, and it's made it to our hymn book, and it's so wonderful.
Hope and power.
Yes. I didn't come to do commerce at all. What I came to do, at least part of this at the beginning, is to introduce you to a treasure among you. For those of you who don't know, Frances Menlow, she was one of the five original founders of Dialogue. Long career in psychology, as a psychologist and things like that. She's now a hospice chaplain. 2 weeks ago, she was in Marysville, Washington, with the Red Cross in the aftermath of that school shooting. She's a treasure among you. She's lived in Depot Bay for a long time, but this last year, she's begun to transition her life here to Portland. So if you don't know her, I want you to meet her. And I brought five copies of this book that we did together. I edited it for her, but it's there's no pastoral voice I enjoy more than hers. And this is a book of essays. The Challenge of Honesty was an essay in the very first issue of Dialogue. Life-changing essay for so many people. And then the rest of this is mostly devotional writings from her years at Sunstone and things like that. It was such an honor to edit her at Sunstone all the time. Anyway, this book is here if anybody wants it. $20, normally $28. So if you do, and if you don't, and we'll be happy to sign them, right? If you don't, we'll assume you already have it. But don't worry, they're up here on consignment. No big deal at all. Am I being heard? I guess I really have to go this close, don't I? Even last night, I was talking with Lindsay, and I said, should this talk be a talk or a testimony? She said, can you do both somehow? And she gave the phrase, you know, a message of hope or something like that. I have in my heart these youth anonymously. We don't know what we might touch today. And when she said a message of hope, I immediately went to 2 Peter 3, where we're encouraged at all times, anyone who's a disciple of Christ, to be ready to stand and to give witness to the hope that is within us. And as I began to ponder on that, I ended up writing an outline here that's mostly personal narrative at the beginning. It's fun to have Kirk talk about parables. I'm going to spend some time with one of the wonderful parables of Christ. And I'll probably be pretty note-free at that point. Maybe the third section I'll need to stick a little closer because it comes together, I think, and hopefully a way that does it. For those of you that listen to the podcast, some of this may be familiar, but hopefully it'll come together in a good way for a good set of moments together. The lyrics. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. In telling of my own story of being lost and found, I'm also going to be talking about several moments of grace that were turning points in my life, were encouragers in my life, that have led me to what I can only call, especially the last 5 years, maybe the last 10 years, a feeling of being in grace most of the time. And the ability that has given me to offer grace, because it's something in my life is off, and I'm, you know, human, and I can I can fall out, but that's the story I want to tell along with those moments. You know, if we'd lost something, we were aware that we once had it, right? And that's the only reason we go searching for it. That's the only thing there's something missing. There's a hole, there's a loss or a lack. And so really what this story, I believe, always is, and I think this is the human story, I'm going to tell it in Mormon terms. I'm going to tell it in Christian terms and using Christian and Mormon symbols and things like this. But I do think that this is the human story world over. I think any tradition, any person, anybody, I think that hopefully what I've shared today is universal, even though you'll be hearing it in these terms that I know are triggers for a lot of us right now, right? Those Mormon stories, those Mormon things and whatnot, we have to sometimes just remember what's below those. You know, I was a kid that had it all. I was the kid who had sports come easy to me. You know, I was of average size, good coordination, a quick mind, parents who nurtured exploration of thought, you know, somehow or other just through their interesting way of interacting with us as kids. I think all of us kids learn to ask questions all along the way. You know, just within the Mormon narrative, I was the golden boy. I was the example. The young mothers, you know, my son looks up to you. You know, my 8 or 9 year old, he wants to be just like you, and thank you for your example and things like that. But because life was so easy for me, when it came to 16, 17, and looking at adulthood, I balked. I was afraid of those responsibilities. And so I, not at first determined, but pretty soon I realized this is going to help me because guess what? I get to make me forget all about that potential, forget about all those expectations. That they had for me. I can just show them that, you know, all this pedestal and all this stuff is, you know, all the pressure would be off. So year after year, for about 5 years, I just chose the easy way. Chose it. It became so important for me to get that Grandma Coke for the weekend. It became so, you know, important. It was interesting. I don't know if any of you had your bank just say, we are closing your account on you because of, you know, they're making $20 a transaction for all the things that I was floating and all those kinds of things, but it was just ridiculously out of control with just hiding. But interestingly, a couple of moments of grace that I noticed, and it would cause me to reflect. For a couple of years, towards the end of this period, every Christmas season, I was in Utah, and for F1 100 has Christmas songs on from basically Thanksgiving, 24 hours a day, on FM 100. And here I'm normally on the hard rock stations, the, you know, Mr. Rolling Stones and all that kind of stuff in the 70s, 80s, early 80s here. I would just catch myself shooting over to FM 100 just to hear. And it was like, I don't any of the Winter Wonderland or Jack Frost nipping at your nose or any of that stuff, I just moved back on. But if there was Christmas nativity, Jesus, the spiritual ones there, I just crave it. And I couldn't understand it. I what the heck? And, you know, years later I wrote that, you know, instead of marijuana grass, I was craving manger hay. You know, It was so strange. And then there was just this weird period for a few months where my life was around from Thursday to Saturday night was in the clubs. And then for a while there, I just would show up at church without thinking, you know, hungover, whatever those things would be. I would just show up and I'd sit in the back in sacrament meeting. I wouldn't smile. I wouldn't make eye contact. I didn't even know that people knew. I would wander down to sit in the back row of the young adult Sunday school class. I don't know that I knew any of their names. I was surprised that they knew my name. And the only way I found out was after a couple of months, the class president goes, Dan, would you give the closing prayer? And I froze. I couldn't. I hadn't prayed in so many years. And it just like caught me off guard. And I'm like, and luckily, one fellow, who I kind of noticed him as somebody that I think kind of knew that I was in a struggle, and he popped up after an uncomfortable 30 seconds or whatever and just said the prayer and didn't say a word or anything like that. I'm not sure that I went back. But I'm like, what's going on with me? Why am I'm feeling these deeper stirrings from stuff that I've rejected, I was rejecting, but they were there. eventually, some of you will know I had an aunt and uncle when I'm 23 years old invite me to live with them. I knew them as a youth. We, you know, kind of interacted with them. We all lived in San Diego together. They had moved to Mapleton, Utah. And just out of the blue, they called me to invite me to their house, this stinky, partying person, to come live with their six children, you know, all at least 5 to 15 years younger than me. Why? I don't know. But just magically, being in their house, it was a very Mormon house. He was the bishop. But they just lived it with ease. They lived it without pressure. There was just something in there that began to wake up within me. You know, this message of who I am, this deeper sense of something. Eventually that fall, I was challenged to read the Book of Mormon, and I did. But I really didn't get that far till you run into the Sons of Mosiah and, you know, Alma the Younger. And I don't know to this day that they're historical figures, but they worked on me. You know, examples of guys that had it all were clearly just on the wrong path. And if they could change, maybe I could. And I paced my room, you know, I'll exaggerate and pretend that it was a week or two, but it was just so clear that I needed to pray. It was so clear that I just do it, but I just couldn't do it. And I would throw myself down on my knees next to the bed, and then I'd try for a second, and I'd get up, and I'd give it up for that night. And that night, finally, I just did. And slowly but surely, I mean, actually, the very first prayer was just simply sobbing. It was just, what a mess. What a mess I've become. I'm so sorry. And I thought that I needed to grovel, and I thought that I needed to beg, and I thought that I needed to do everything. And there was nothing that I felt from God at all that said that those were the things that he demanded. Instead, it was a sense of, I've been watching you, but I've never lost sight of the divinity in you. I never lost sight of that. Welcome back. We got some work to do, but welcome. Welcome back. That fall, I also chose to go on a mission. So nearly age 24, I'm entering the mission field. A moment of grace came that Christmas. I was scheduled to come to Seattle in February, and so that Christmas was all mission stuff. So I got my overcoat, I got the big plastic cover for my scriptures because they're going to be in the back of my bike getting wet and all that stuff. And I just, my family, who I completely ostracized for years, were sitting around after the presents were open. We're just laughing, we're just doing the things, and I had that lovely experience of sort of stepping out of time and be able to look back. And I just looked at them and I said, at the ease at which we were together again, they don't remember me. They don't remember me from those years. You know, whatever that remember you no more, remember anything but the brightness in you. It was a testimony, it was a wonderful moment of grace. I want to talk about the prodigal son. For any of you who've looked at wider scripture studies about the prodigal son, it's not always called the parable of the prodigal son. It's called the parable of the two lost sons for many people, because there are two sons there, both lost in different ways. The one that gets all the attention is the son like me, the one who had divinity, had it all, asked to go into this world and to give it a try, and he basically fell flat. And we know that, you know, he fell so flat, however many years, I'm sure it wasn't his intention to go end up with the pigs, right? It wasn't his intention, every good intention. He went off into the world to just be myself, to do this adventure called life. And he fell flat. And there's, you know, King James translation is always iffy. There are some beautiful poetry and wonderful things. You know, gave us the gift of the word atonement and all those kinds of things. But there is that wonderful phrase in there, what happened when he was down. He comes to himself. Now, he didn't fully come to himself at this time, but he just began to think, you know, there was something going on in here that my life was better. And even with Dad
even the just the lowest in his group, at least fed, right? So what's the next part of the story? He begins his journey back, and what's Dad's reaction? Just even the hearing, a whiff of a rumor that he was, you know, came to himself, brought Father aware, rushing out to him. And as they greet each other, it's the son on the ground, head down around Father's knees, and the Father is simply saying, and he says, let me be your servant. Let me just do it. And what's Father's immediate reaction? Please, go get the robe, get the ring, get the sandals. You're not my servant, you're always my son. These are the tokens of familyhood. This is the tokens of divinity. I never forgot you, even when you're away. And I want you to know that. And so we only get that part of the story, other than kill the fatted calf and we'll have a celebration. But there in that story is clearly another, who knows, 20 years, lifetime of this son needing the tutelage, but always with the answer of, you're divine, you're my son, you have not lost your way fully. But of course, then we have the other son, the other lost son. We only get a few verses there, and what's his deal? How is he lost? He's lost in righteousness, in being dutiful. He's lost from cut off, his heart is cut off because he was so sure that this was the path, this is the things that I should do, this is the way to please Father, and things like this, that he, you know, many things that you said today were, you know, you can just kind of see this unthinkingly doing things, very judgmental and things like this. And it's a quick thing to note. If you look at Luke 15 where this is, it begins, the chapter begins with these are three parables that he tells in the presence of the Pharisees. Who are looking to trip him up. And he tells the lost coin, he tells the lost sheep, and he tells this story here. And so when he goes, so what happens? The son won't come to celebrate the brother, right? He won't come to do that. And he's off sulking. And so in his lostness, what happens again? The father goes and finds him. And Mormons, we misread this so badly. Most of Christianity reads this so badly. What does he say next? Don't worry, son. Your salvation is secure. Everything that I have is yours. And we tend to read that as like, yeah, we're throwing a nice party for this guy. But you're really the one that's got it all, right? You're the one there. Absolutely not. In each case, he said to them, let's begin a conversation. So I'm going to put you at ease, son. You know, I see how messed up you are here. I'm going to put you at ease right away with this statement to him about, don't worry, we'll get there together with you too. So lost in different ways. Lost in the way that I would think that most of us who have struggled within Mormonism encounter most often, right? It's, life hasn't thrown them the curve. We still trust the formulas. We still think that activity means that we're developing a heart of compassion. All those different lostnesses we find there, and they're so difficult to see. And the only way we can break through, and with that message, is with the message of love, is with the message of grace, even to them, as they're not offering it to us. Let me just, I'm sure my time is about up, and this third section shouldn't take too long. That I wanted to make sure that I kind of walked through a little bit here. I'm able to walk through Mormonism. And I know many of you aren't. And that's fine. I'm able to do it because I've been able to find elements within Mormonism that speak to the experience that I share today. There's affirmations after affirmations of an uncreatedness, of a divinity, of potential, of that this life is supposed to be veiled.
that this life is supposed to be full of distractions, that this life is full of anguish and pain, so much so that at least in the Mormon narrative, a lot of people chose against adventure, just like that elder son chooses against adventure versus that of the younger son. I've been able to see all those things in Mormonism. I've been able to somehow come to a place where I'm no longer, I guess the word is triggered. Because it's so clear that that stuff's there. And it's so clear that if you start talking about it, everyone realizes it's there. You know, and they just forgot it, and it's just been buried in things like this. And it's frustrating, and it's hard, but it is there. And so I've been able to do that. I've been able to figure out that all those things that are covering up this core are just human. They're from fear. They're from a willingness to sit complacent and to not really engage life. It may not be the case for each of you, for those children who we have in our hearts today. For them and for you, Mormonism and Christianity, I know, can mean nothing but judgment and shame and pain. The key for all of us is for us to hear God as directly as possible. But I know that for many of us, we can't do that. Many for these children, what it requires is us to speak for God. It requires for us in these messages that we write on them to say, I see you. I see nothing but brightness. I see nothing but divinity. I just, you know, all this other stuff is just covered up crap. This is your particular thing. And we see your pain. We honor your pain. We know your pain. Let us all be somewhat God's proxies tonight. And as we go forward, to just convey that, because that's I'm convinced that is the only message. This is the only message of all world religions, is that you're lost. It's been covered over. You've forgotten. Whether it's Eastern practices and things like that get you out of your ego mind, that get you out of all those things that distract you and you identify your emotions with all that stuff, or the same thing, all the other layers here. The core of all the human journey is they're divine. There's nothing in you that can be damaged. No core thing. So the namaste, I bow to the God within you. I bow, I see it. To acknowledge that, to look into eyes, that's all that we need to do. As I kind of said at the beginning, this has happened to me. I know grace. I don't know if Jesus is grace, you know, get rid of all the categories that have to tie it to that. But when we truly know grace ourselves, we can give grace. When we truly know grace ourselves, we can hear somebody come at us with anger or judgment or something like that and be able to kind of say, I don't recognize those for anger and judgment and shame. I recognize those for something deeper, for fear, for deeper loss, loneliness, or something like that. And when we meet loss and loneliness and fear, what is our natural reaction? Let me nurture you. You know? We screw up. I screw up all the time. We're so human. It's no fun to have somebody come at you with all of that and to be able to step into it. And so I fail left and right. But whatever it is, my journey and what my testimony is that finding your core within God, within spirit, whatever it is, send down those signals. Reach down and just know that what's going to come back to you is never going to be shaming. It's never going to be guilt-inducing and things like that. If it is those things, or like what Kirk said, if your enemies are the exact same ones as God's enemies, it's all those things that we've built up for ourselves. That's not the message we'll get from God. That's not the message I know. It's not the message these quilts will send. And I just thank you for allowing me to give reason for the hope that is in me, the peace that's in me. And I just see nothing but brightness and glory in all of you. And I'm a huge failure on so many things. But this is why I'm able to hang where I'm hanging, and I'll offer that for those who've been here. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
To be. I I'm going to go ahead and make myself comfortable.
Sit on the table.
Well, if it collapses, I guess that'll just make things more interesting. So I've decided to title my remarks More Than 50 Shades of Grey. The bad news is that probably makes my talk sound a little more titillating than it actually will be. For the past few years, I've been an associate producer on Kendall Wilcox documentary film project Far Between, which seeks to explore the experience of Mormons who identify as LGBT. Can you hear me? I have to practically make out with the mic in order to be heard. The past few years, I've been an associate producer on Kendall Wilcox documentary film project called Far Between, which seeks to explore the experience of Mormons who are LGBT, identify as LGBT, or same-sex attracted. And we've interviewed people all along the spectrum of spirituality, sexuality, and gender identity. And one important thing I've learned in the process is the power and the healing potential inherent in allowing a person to tell his or her own story in his or her own words. And I suppose this concept shouldn't have surprised me. As I have had countless interviews with priesthood leaders who were seeking to help with what at the time I called my same-sex attraction. And I had a lot of well-intentioned bishops who struggled to know how to help me. And as a result, handed me ill-fitting narratives and paradigms that had been handed to them. And I didn't see them as ill-fitting at the time. If I wasn't successful living up to them, it was because of my own failings and my own weakness. There were a lot of narratives at church that didn't really fit or help me understand who I was. I also couldn't identify with narratives and paradigms of what, at the time, I would have called the gay lifestyle. Having grown up in Sandy, Utah, in the 80s, I had a very limited and vague understanding of who a gay man was. And it included men who mostly lived in San Francisco, wore cutoff jean shorts and tube socks, and had mustaches, and spread a deadly disease that was transmitted sexually. And that's about all I knew. And obviously, that as a Mormon boy growing up in Sandy in the 80s, that wasn't something I identified with either.
As opposed to now.
What's that? As opposed to now. Right, right. Anyways, I suppose it should come as no shock that in my adolescence, I wasn't really all that happy. I was never bullied. I wasn't suicidal or severely depressed, but I just felt this constant general sense of not feeling like I fit in anywhere or knowing who I was. And I realize that's pretty much the experience of most people in adolescence. It's not necessarily unique to gay Mormons. But I realize now that the sadness that I felt resulted from the fact that I saw little in the world around me that helped me understand who I was. Whether it was at church, at school, in books, or movies, none of what I was exposed to was about a young Mormon boy who was attracted to his male peers and how he handled that, reconciling that with the beliefs he was brought up with. Nothing. If anything, the media I was exposed to taught me that, and particularly at church, what I was exposed to taught me that I shouldn't trust my most basic instincts because what I felt wasn't okay. So basically, I reached a point where the narratives that I was hearing were inadequate. And whatever the opposite of empowering is, that's what they were. There were some good narratives, but it's like trying to put on a pair of size 9 shoes onto size 11 feet. I walked around often feeling uncomfortable and ill at ease. And it wasn't until after I had my heart broken for the first time that I began to realize that I could construct narratives on my own, that I could forge my own path. When I was Elders Quorum president, I fell in love with one of the guys in my ward. And obviously there's a whole story there that would make up a whole other talk, so I'm not going to delve into too many of the details there. But Looking back, I feel that God tricked me into falling in love so that he or she could destroy what I thought I knew about the world and start from scratch, helping me build a new sense of self with narratives that fit. So that was what led me into questioning what was handed to me by the church about what my life should look like, and I started gradually trusting my own instincts and connecting to the Spirit in more, I guess, empowering ways, and found a lot of trusted guides and mentors and teachers along the way that helped foster a space of being able to wrestle with some of these questions in an open-ended way instead of trying to tell me what things meant. And so as I went through that process, I really began to see that one of the greatest gifts that I can give those around me, one of the greatest ways I can show love for those around me, is to allow them that same space to work through their own stuff, to craft their own narratives without trying to push my own agenda, to show enough genuine curiosity so as to facilitate their process without imposing my own plan. And it's easy for me to see how Mormon culture failed me in this way, to see how some very strict and narrow narratives tried to funnel me into an identity that didn't fit. Just an example of that, I remember on my mission was when I first started coming to terms with my sexuality, and also on my mission, I had quite a bit of success teaching and baptizing single middle-aged women for some reason. We clicked.
Middle-aged woman whisperer.
And seeing through my thick Mormon lens at the time, the way I made sense of this with my attraction to other men, I wondered if part of the purpose of my mission was to bring these single women into the fold and then have them in the next life as my wives, when I would be perfect and attracted to ladies. Yikes. But these are the mental gymnastics I went through trying to make sense of. It was like an awful mashup of two bizarre Mormon theologies, or at least theologies that didn't fit, that I tried to make fit. So it's easy to see how the narratives that were given to me failed. What's much harder to do is identify in myself the ways that I do the same to others. At times it's hard to not want to force my beliefs and narratives on family members who believe differently than I do. It's hard to just simply accept them where they're at. It's difficult to try to live authentically while at the same time allowing others to do the same. It's a tricky balance to strike. It's also been difficult for me to be generous of spirit towards other gay Mormons who make choices that are exactly in line with what the church prescribes. Kendall Wilcox interviewed Josh and Molly Weed for Far Between. And if you're not familiar with them, Josh and Molly live up in the Seattle area. Josh is gay and Mormon and wrote a blog post coming out, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, that went viral. And so Kendall wanted to interview them, and he asked my boyfriend and I to accompany him to man the cameras for the interview. And so heading in, I had a lot of thoughts about who they might be, about how the interview would go. I even had thoughts of, you know, what if exposing myself to their story would cause me to have doubts about my own choices that I've made in my life. And just mixing rogue gay Mormons and same-sex relationships with fully active and believing gay Mormons and mixed orientation marriages has the potential for an ugly gay Mormon showdown. Sharks versus jets, choreographed fighting, menacing snapping. But I actually came out of that experience feeling something completely unexpected. I was really surprised when I came away actually genuinely liking the weeds quite a bit. And at the same time feeling more secure in the own choices that I'd made for myself. Listening to their story in their own words, it made sense to me why they would make the choices that they have, even if I wouldn't make the same ones. It was clear to me that we prioritized our beliefs differently, and that our spiritual orientations differed, even if our sexual orientations had some similarities, and that was perfectly okay. As it turns out, even within the tiny intersection of homosexuality and Mormonism, there's room for more than 50 shades of gray. There are two quotes that I want to end with that kind of, I think, summarize these ideas really well. One, the first one is by a Buddhist nun, and I'm not really sure how to pronounce her name, so if anybody does know, feel free to correct me. I believe it's Pema Chodron.
You got it right.
Thank you. she says, "Could our minds and our hearts be big enough just to hang out in that space where we're not entirely certain about who's right and who's wrong? Could we have no agenda when we walk into a room with another person? Not know what to say, not make that person wrong or right? Could we see, hear, feel other people as they really are? It is powerful to practice this way because we'll find ourselves continually rushing around to try to feel secure again, to make ourselves or them either right or wrong. But true communication can happen only in that open space." The second quote is by an American theologian named Bernard Loomer. And he talks about the size of a person. And he says, "By size, I mean the stature of your soul, the range and depth of your love, your capacity for relationships. I mean the volume of life you can take into your being and still maintain your integrity and individuality, the intensity and variety of outlook you can entertain in the unity of your being without feeling defensive or insecure. I mean the strength of your spirit to encourage others to become freer in the development of their diversity and uniqueness. I mean the power to sustain more complex and enriching tensions. I mean the magnanimity of concern to provide conditions that enable others to increase in stature." Well, thanks.
Okay, I'm getting choked up already, I think it's all of this. Because I've been sitting here thinking, I'm a bit of a perfectionist for those who know me, and so this has been a really interesting format for me to try to do something different. People that know me are saying that's not true. And so I'm sitting there thinking, and you know, my mind is someone who's organized this, like, all the things that could go wrong, and did we do this wrong, and did we use the wrong space, and you know, there's this weird energy because there's quilting, there's noise, and people are talking, and it was interesting that everyone talked about all these paradigm shifts and stories and orthodoxy and things like that. And I was thinking of something that happened to me a few months ago. I used to serve the young women's, and about 3 or 4 months ago, I had one of my young women come visit me, actually, after meeting me at the grocery store. And when she first saw me at the grocery store, it was this passive aggressive, like, "Why don't you go to church anymore?" And I was like, "Well, you know, I don't really like the way that we treat gay people in the church right now. Like, I wasn't prepared for that. This is what came out. And she just said, oh, your baby's cute. Like, that's where we went. But she, it was like a super awkward thing. And I thought, oh, gosh, that could have been handled better. But she actually came over to my house a little while later. And she said, Sister Park, I just need to talk to you. I'm really struggling. I think I might be gay. And this was not a surprise to me as her young woman leader. I just always kind of expected. But she said something. She said, I can't tell my parents. My dad said that if any of his kids ever turned out gay, and we were called to go to Zion, he wouldn't take them with them. I could never tell my parents that I'm gay. And it's just, she said, it's just such a struggle. Like, for me to go to Zion would be such a struggle. And I've been thinking about those words. Struggle to go to Zion. And I was like, yes, well, that's what it is. Like, finding Zion is a struggle. So I was thinking about this and paradigm shifts and how we're doing things different. And I just really appreciate you all coming today and struggling towards Zion. We're doing things different. It's a little unorthodox. The perfectionist part of me is like, no, it should be this way and it should be all quiet. But I think for me, I'm going to challenge myself to always struggle. Sunstone is going to be doing some things different. And I know that that's going to be disrupting to some people, but I appreciate those who are willing to struggle with us. And it will be a struggle. And we might get things wrong and we might get things right. But I just really appreciate everyone being willing to be part of the struggle. So thank you. And with that said, we're going to get into the more rowdy part of the evening. So I'm going to turn the time over to Aunt Marvel. But make sure that you have tied a knot in the quilt before you go. Oh, and written on the quilt, absolutely.
Frantically searching for my notes for the last hour and a half, and my daughter had them. I said, what would I do without you? She said, die. So, the older daughter, the one that everyone thinks is my sister. Kidding. Talk about Mormon food, and I'll have you know I'm a highly respected scientist, and I like to talk to you a little bit about my background. So I earned my BMI from Kraft Foods at the age of 12, and then I went on to do some undergraduate work with the King, and I did some postgraduate work in dairy sciences at BYU in the late 80s. And then I went on to do some specific work in the early 90s with toddlers and babies. And we all lived, barely. So, and then right now I operate a laboratory in Southern Oregon. Where I perform a sort of Rorschach test on 18 to 19-year-olds, sometimes 20-year-old young men, during missions, Oregon Eugene Mission. Mission President does not love me. And then yesterday I did a focus group in Seattle where we also discussed some Mormon food, and I was able to extrapolate some more data from that group. I'm going to present tonight. So, this is just sort of the Mormon food I think that we're all familiar with, maybe with less eggs, I don't know. No matter where anyone is on the faith spectrum, I think food is a familiar hallmark. It's comforting to us. We can bridge the spaces in our belief with the nearly universal experience that is Mormon food. Oh, curses. Sorry, this is super touchy. So what I did was I patterned my research after Mrs. Obama's research, where she talks about the plate and how this is how your plate should look if you're going to have a healthy diet. So I decided to look into how Mormon food looks on the plate. And this is what I was able to discover. And I think it's really important to note that we do the full 10% of our milk. We don't just go for 2% or 1%. We like that full 10%. Mormons, that they're not just in Utah, they're all over the world. So I tried to look specifically at Utah. Wait, what happened here? Utah Mormons. Right? Which I was surprised that there's that many visits to the Lion House, and then I found out they sell them at Deseret Books, so that explains the huge proportion of Lion House rolls being eaten in Utah. And then, what the heck happened here? What is going on? Grace, what happened to this? Okay.
Where did this player fall?
Okay. Oh, right. So here's... Sorry. So we have mission food, right? This is Mormon. There's also mission food, which you can see. Right. My husband did not serve a mission. He was in the military, so I hear a lot about Balut. So if you enjoy Balut, you are interesting. Probably the one person married to me. So then this is the Utah Mormon, right? Outside of, just drilling down the data a little bit, Utah Mormons. And then this is what food looks like out in the mission field outside of the Mormon corridor, where we like, our actual salad, our fancy cheeses, right? I don't know. This is actually what my plate looks like on any given day. So I felt like that was probably appropriate. And then this is what the apostate plate looks like. I know. It's cool. It might be. It's a little
difficult. I can testify on that.
Science doesn't lie, folks. Science does not lie. So out of curiosity, I decided to look at the data for Boyd K. Packer's three favorite populations within the Mormon church. And this is, so this is what the feminists eat. My 6-year-old daughter is grateful she escaped my feminist awakening. So is my 20-year-old daughter, for that matter. All right. And then also the gays. So this is what their food looks like.
Monster mage.
Yeah. And actually, this is all based on my relationship with my brother. So that's also and then this is the intellectuals.
Massage. Kale
must be massaged.
We can testify to that.
What was that?
It's just Portland.
Hey, welcome back from Europe.
Hello.
So what am I going to do with all this data? I have collected all this data, and it's highly, so I got to do something with it. So I've devised a way for us to judge pantries. And this is a typical Mormon pantry. It's not mine, but it's fairly typical. So there's this. This is a righteous pantry. This is found in a righteous pantry. A cream mushroom soup, more than one box of Jell-O, some canning equipment, number 10 cans with maybe no labels or little past the labels on them, some Nutella. I don't know. That's just what data says. Okay. Sorry, there's like legit scientists in here who I'm sure hate me. All right. And then, so then we've got the next pantry. This is the Portland pantry. Well, you may need to call your executive secretary to schedule an appointment so the bishop can set you on the right path to righteousness. You need some more cream mushroom soup in your pantry. And then this pantry, this is an automatic slippery slope. Trip on a slippery slope to apostasy. I mean, cream and celery soup, that's clearly something made out of the devil's vegetables. And alcohol, I know people say, oh, I use it for cooking, but nobody believes that. And we don't even know what Vienna sausages are made of. So clearly all of these, send them away to scouting for food. And So I have a couple of pantries for us to look at in my research. And here's the first one, and we can see like some coconut milk here, and some pumpkin, some tuna. I don't know, this person's a little sketchy. There's various cans of something soup up there. I don't see any cream of celery. And but this is also my pantry, so from that way you'd like to. And then there's this pantry that I found, which I think is interesting because it's all like equipment and box of Cheerios. Good Mormon family there. I do not know what happened. I've already alerted the cleric. And then there is this pantry, which I also believe might have been a crime scene photo. I don't know. They swear there's flour and sugar in those buckets. I have no clue. Powdered white stuff, right? And then this pantry is either, I can't tell if it's a pantry with feminists because it has babies in it, or if it's being presided over by future priesthood leaders. hard to tell. And then this pantry, clearly blessed from above. Right. Interesting. We also have real maple syrup, so probably apostate. And then this, right, because nobody can afford to feed that to their children.
They're not paying their tithing.
I said that, I love it. And then there's this pantry, which is clearly celestial, although she swears there's meat in that freezer. I'm not sure. But I don't want to cast aspersions with Alice Fisher Roberts' pantry. It's too sweet to kill anyone, right? All right. So the next thing, this is what I did in Seattle. In Seattle, I did some highly scientific research on the Hawaiian haystack. Who here has had a Hawaiian haystack before? Kaini says it's not truly Hawaiian, but what does he know? He lives in San Diego. So this is what a Hawaiian haystack looks like. It's just a pile of junk. Sauce, right? But as you go down the line, I've been able to tell what your future calling might be. So if you choose white rice, you're clearly white and delightsome, which means you'll be a bishop. If you go with brown rice, you're always destined to be a counselor. Right? All right. And then I also served chicken gravy, which obviously you're really society president, right? Homemade from scratch. But if you like curry, probably best is a compassionate service. Dealing with people nobody else wants to deal with. It's probably best for you. And then, if you like meat, before meat, maybe you should be a gospel doctrine teacher. If you like tofu, you're probably best as a door greeter. Sacrament meeting. Clearly, if you put either one of these on your Hawaiian haystack, you're destined for primary. Scouts, because obviously you don't mind bad smells. Extended bad smells. Frankly. And then Crazen's obviously the nursery. It's just science, guys. So, So this was yesterday. This was me studying. And I want you to notice here. Oh, let me get my pointer. It's highly important. We have a lot of chicken gravy, almost out of curry. You know what we're saying about those Seattle people. Also, they complained that nothing was free range or organic. So those jerks. Anyway,
you're important. Mushrooms.
What? let's see. So then, I want to talk about casseroles a little bit. This is actually an ad campaign I suggested to the church when they rejected it in favor of families. Which I was really annoyed by, and obviously that went over like a lead balloon. So holding on for casseroles. I created what I call the casserole matrix to help you create a true and proper casserole. And the first thing you're going to want in your casserole matrix is your protein. And your options, ground beef, chicken, Spam, leftover turkey from Thanksgiving, probably in a Ziploc bag in your freezer, am I right? Maybe hot dogs or tuna, good options for protein. For a vegetable, a proper Mormon casserole is probably going to have frozen broccoli, corn, onions, corn, or corn. Peas, nope. And for a binder, you're going to want some sort of cream soup, right? Let's make. So we got cream of mushroom, cream of chicken, cream of celery, although it's judgmental. Cream of broccoli, condensed tomato soup, or some mayonnaise. I had a college roommate who made casserole with mayonnaise. So I don't know what happened to her. And then you're going to want a starch, anything from this list of starches. And then maybe a topping, crackers, cornflakes, breadcrumbs, happy socks, Velveeta,
and foil,
right. So when I presented this research in Salt Lake, I created a casserole based on the matrix here, and it had hot dogs, corn, and cream mushroom soup, and hash brown potatoes, and Velveeta. And it was delicious, right? Oh, no, you're lying.
It was gooey.
I will say that Lisa Butterworth had 4 helpings. Right? So, I created a copy of the casserole matrix for each one of you with a magnet for your refrigerator. The best thing to do is to roll, I'll pass these around. You can each have one. And then you can put it on your refrigerator. Roll a dice, right? Roll a dice.
Roll
it's your protein. Roll a dice. It's your vegetable. It's the perfect way to create a casserole. This is science, guys. Factual science. All right. So, for a moment, I want to talk about Jell-Os. Jell-O salad. In all my research, I was able to create a flowchart of Jell-O salad. And I would like a volunteer. Have a volunteer? Not you, Bonnie. All right. Yours, thanks.
You can have Jell-O.
Oh, all right. Sarah MC.
She just got for eating babies in Amsterdam.
Babies, really? That's what you did in Amsterdam? So what I'm presenting to you now is the official Jell-O flow chart.
Okay.
So, Sarah, I would like to know, is it time for Jell-O?
Let's see. Yes.
Because if you'd said no, I would have told you to try again. Right? So we're going to pick a flavor. Did you wait to date until you were 16?
No. Yeah.
You did? Oh, you get strawberry Jell-O. But wait.
No.
Just trying to avoid that. If you'd said no, I would have asked, are you an Eagle Scout?
No.
Then, if you were, you would get orange Jell-O. Do you have a sofa made out of food storage?
No.
Okay, well, then you're avoiding lemon Jell-O. Are you the ward librarian?
No.
Okay, then you're avoiding lime Jell-O. Have you ever had a calling in Cub Scouts?
Nope.
No blue Jell-O for you. Do you laugh at fart jokes?
Yes.
Then you get grape Jell-O. Excellent. The Jell-O of no taste. Now we're going to add some mix-ins. I need to know. Are you the most boring person ever?
No.
Okay. Then you're avoiding fruit cocktail. Do you blog for by common consent?
Nope.
Okay. Then we are avoiding shredded carrots. Did you go to BYU Hawaii?
No, I did not.
No pineapple for you. Have you lost the ability to smell and or taste food?
No.
Then no canned shrimp. That's canned shrimp. All right. Are you 90 years old?
No.
So no canned pears. Is it a holiday?
No.
No chopped nuts. Are you concerned about the health of your colon?
Nope.
Then no celery. So, then you get to add ennui. And your jello will be clear. How would you like to serve your salad? Is it going to a ward potluck?
Probably.
Then you will want to put it in a 9x13 can. Is your mother coming over for dinner?
Sure.
Then she would like a dollop of mayonnaise on top. Do you think this is a salad?
No.
Oh, okay. Then you don't have to put it on a leaf of lettuce. So, this is the Michelle Jello flow chart. And yeah, I'm done. So the next thing that I need to talk about is marvelous cake and a cobbler. This is new for Portland, I'll have you know. Seattle has not seen this. This is a story about my pioneer heritage. And there are two women in my ancestry. We had Betty Crocker Smith. Famous for her cakes. And then we had Sarah Marie Callender Smith, who was famous for her pies. And they were always fighting. And they carried these recipes across the plains, tucked against their bosoms. It was very important for them to keep those recipes. And there was a lot of my cake is better than your pie, my pie is better than your cake. And it actually came to blows. It started to get really ugly. And then, so then my great-great-grandfather stepped in. And his name is Cool Whip. And he suggested a compromise between the ladies that ended this way. So they decided to combine their talents, and then this is the new recipe that is my family heritage, which is the pie baked inside of the cake, or as we call it, a marvelous cake and a cobbler, and that is what we will be eating tonight. Nobody's more excited than a 6-year-old. All right. And so there's another thing that I need to talk about, and that is in the year 2008, the Children's Friend, there was a recipe produced called Candlestick Salad, and let me check my notes. Hold on. This is important. I don't want to miss date. Oh. All right. So, the church put out this very interesting... Okay, I don't know what I'm doing here. Grace, help. Left foot. Okay.
Oh. Right click.
Whoa! Okay. Whoop. All right. So, the church put out this very interesting set of instructions by Ms. Paula Reed, which I will now demonstrate for you. Hold on just one moment. What we have So we're gonna take a banana. First, I need some pineapple rings. Now, I use these pineapple rings in Seattle, and somehow they deflated between Seattle and Portland. I do not know how that happened. What? I do not know how that happened, but look, they're like pineapple chips now. It's all right.
They look like they're having some kind of dysfunction there. Yeah.
So you're going to take a couple of those, and you're going to peel a banana. And you'll want to partner up with a friend. You do not want a whole banana. That's just greedy. And you're going to take that banana and stand it in your seat. And now we're seeing the formation of the candle. And then we're going to take...
This is actually a recipe of banana bread.
A toothpick.
Yeah, it really honestly did.
Huh?
You can find it on LDS.org.
Yes. I actually have the edition, the magazine this is in. December 2008. And you're going to take your cherry and put it in the top to look like a flame. And then it also calls for some whipped cream on the end. And some of us are dairy intolerant, so... And I put a little coconut around the base. I'll tell you that the children's friend calls for alfalfa sprouts, which I hate.
Now,
so,
being more
politically
correct, can we toast that coconut too?
Sorry, what was that?
Can we toast the coconut?
You could toast the coconut, but I am in my 40s, so I prefer it white. And if you'd like, we have all the supplies for you to make your own candle salad, and I invite you to do so now. Don't be shy. You have to be able to say you've had a candle salad.
Go make me a
candle
salad.
So are married people able to make these?
Yes. I'm not sure why the question. It's a candle.
It's really for children.
Yes, because I think anything goes.
Right.
You can only make a candle salad with a sister wife.
All right.
And you give this to the missionaries, right?
I do serve this to the missionaries. I tell them it's a family tradition. We like to light a candle in their honor. And
you can find that on YouTube.
And all but one missionary has been really appreciative of my gift. And one was not, and for a while the mission president said they were not allowed to come to my home. He is candleist, apparently. So, please come and enjoy a candle salad.
So if you guys want to form a line to try this, and then will you be getting that?
I'm getting the other stuff ready now, yes.
Okay, so come line up. We want people to try this if you're not banana adverse.
Everybody's
talking. Come on, guys.
It's just